This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
In the end, we have to say we've got to appeal to as many voters as we can and try to get them not to be interested in the opposition. That's what we'll do. And I think that that will probably be enough. I do think that we will probably drop our majority on the county council. I think it's only realistic to think that. But I don't think that we'll be conceding the administration to anybody else.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to this edition of the Kent Politics Podcast. In the week, one councillor is having trouble levelling up, another is blaming foreign lorry drivers for the county's potholes, and why a name change can cost you, the taxpayer, £250,000. My name is Simon Finlay, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Robert Boddy, who looks after Medway.
Hello.
And Daniel Essen, who covers district and borough councils.
Hello.
And standing in for Nicky White this week is our colleague from the Local Democracy Reporting Service, Gabriel Morris, who's been casting an eye over the goings-on at Westminster.
Hello.
Later on, we'll be joined by our special guest, Conservative County Councillor Sean Holden, one of the potentially dozens of Tories who will be stepping down at the local elections next May. First up, Robert, what's been happening in Medway?
So this week, there's been a couple of stories around healthcare providers in Medway, but a particularly notable one is around KMPT, or should I say KMMH, who are paying £250,000 to change their name. But councillors criticise the fact that they failed to get waiting lists down.
Yeah, sounds very grand. Who are these people?
So KMPT is Kent and Medway NHS and Social Care Partnership Trust.
Snappy.
Which is provides a number of services, particularly around mental health and particularly dementia. So they found that patients and their families did not know who they were or what they did, so decided they would simplify their name and become Kent and Medway NHS Mental Health, KMMH. But councillors said if it was just replacing one initialism with another, there wouldn't be much value gained. And what was more important was the fact that waiting times for dementia diagnosis in particular remained high at 22 weeks when the target is supposed to be 6.
So they're spending £250,000 on changing their name while failing to improve fast enough. Is that correct?
That's the gist of what councillors were saying. But in KMPT or KMMH's defence, they say this money was already allocated for updates to signage and communication materials anyway. So it's not additional money being spent on this, rather existing money to be spent to have a greater effect. They do accept they're not making as much progress on getting waiting times down, but insist they're working on it as hard as they can.
And what have you been looking at then, Dan?
I've actually been working on something that Gabriel here spotted. It's about, it looks like Thanet District Council has been unable to find a private firm to help it deliver part of its levelling up project, despite 3 years or so of trying.
And what are they trying to build?
So it's being referred to as a green campus comprising three buildings on some brownfield land near the port of Ramsgate. But as with, you know, almost everything that a local council calls a campus or green for that matter, there's no real confirmation of what the buildings are actually going to be used for. And also, as with so many council regeneration projects, they need private companies to come and do a lot of the work. So Thanet Council are going to build two of three buildings at this site on the port of Ramsgate. And they're also going to apply to themselves for planning permission to build this third building, but they're not actually going to build it themselves. They're going to wait for a private company to come forward and, you know, basically pay to do it. And that's a bit of a problem because no private company has actually come forward offering to do that. And the deadline for that is October 30th.
Presumably people aren't too impressed with any of this.
No, of course not. It's mainly people on the council who are paying any attention to it. But John Davis, Tory opposition councillor, he says that pretty much the whole thing has been mismanaged from the start. And that they're looking at a multi-million pound tin shed with some solar panels on top. There's a group called the Ramsgate Regeneration Alliance, which former MP Lord Craig McKinley chairs. They say basically the same thing, and that a full detailed business plan for this site should have been developed years and years ago.
Okay. So why has the council been so unsuccessful in getting private firms involved in it?
And as usual, you know, probably lots of reasons, only some of which are directly the fault of the council. Thanet's got a massive wind farm off the coast. Kent is increasingly a place where there's lots of solar energy because it's pretty sunny in these parts. parts. So intuitively, you'd imagine that there's plenty of scope for sort of green energy and eco-adjacent businesses to have premises in places in Kent. But the capacity of the state to actually do things, especially in local government, has been completely eroded in sort of previous few decades. So local councils end up entirely dependent on private businesses. I would assume that they chose not to commit the building to any specific use to try and encourage private firms to come forward and make of it what they want. But, you know, for private companies in fields like green tech and energy, you know, a small council like Thanet probably isn't offering them anything which they can deliver pretty easily themselves if they felt like it.
So what's been happening your way, Simon?
Well, winter's on the way, and so that means only one thing, potholes. And Kent County Council's Roads and Transport Chief, Neil Baker, says that Kent gets it worse than other parts of the country, largely due to the volume of foreign lorry drivers and tourist traffic that go through the Channel ports and the Port of Dover and Folkestone.
Surely most of the traffic uses the motorways, the M2 and the M20, and doesn't really get much into local roads.
Well, that's true to a certain extent, but a great deal of that traffic does actually end up on local roads on their way to going elsewhere. And there's a huge amount of freight coming through the docks and the tunnel, and significant amount ends up on local roads. Then there's the tourist traffic, a lot of which ends up on the roads around here. But on top of that, and this is the crucial bit, he says the situation is made worse by underfunding by central government, plus foreign vehicles pay nothing towards the upkeep of the roads they use in this country. I mean, when you travel to France, for example, we have to pay tolls, and the government takes from the motorists in a kind of tax. And the roads in France are generally in better condition, so maybe that's the way to go. But Councillor Baker said officially that it is critical that the government earmarks additional funding for road maintenance in the forthcoming budget so that we can improve the essential Kent highway network that connects our communities and powers our businesses. Of course, he's calling on the Labour government to do it when the previous Conservative government did little to help.
Now, I understand this comes at a time when the AA has issued a new report. What did that say?
Well, this kind of ran alongside what's emerged. The AA appears to bear out what Councillor Baker says, and they say that the number of breakdowns caused directly by potholes to vehicles, i.e. their members, is at 10,000 up year on year, and drivers suffer from punctures, damaged wheels, steering and suspension problems as a result of fissures being hidden by puddles after heavy rain. The AA president, Edmund King, said, "Recently we have seen an increase in vehicle pothole damage as the heavy rain means puddles hide the potholes. The current government knows that all road users are fed up with potholes and has the opportunity to make a step change in the spiral of decline by adopting and advocating measures to permanently fix the problem rather than the past patchwork approach." Okay, Gabriel, what's caught your eye at Westminster this week?
Well, we start actually in Washington. It began when Donald Trump's campaign filed a complaint with the US Federal Election Commission against the Labour Party here in the UK. They accused Labour of blatant foreign interference in the US election, claiming their efforts are helping the Harris-Waltz campaign. The complaint highlights media reports of Labour's contact with the Harris campaign and volunteering efforts, which Trump says amount to illegal contributions. A key part of the complaint comes from a LinkedIn post by Labour's head of operations, Sophia Patel, who offered housing and said nearly 100 volunteers had signed up to the campaign in the US. That post has since been deleted. Well, UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer has downplayed this issue. He's pointed out that Labour has sent volunteers to US elections for many years, and that it's quite normal for the UK and US political parties to have contact. Starmer has also said Labour activists in the States are acting in a personal capacity, and he's dismissed concerns about his relationship with a potential future Trump administration, adding he and Trump even had dinner together at Trump Tower last month.
That sounds nice, but is this activity illegal?
Well, the Trump campaign argues that Labour's involvement amounts to illegal foreign national contributions. They point to previous incidents, such as the Australian Labour Party's involvement in Bernie Sanders' 2016 campaign. However, Labour officials say the party hasn't organised or funded any trips for activists heading to the US. Under US election rules, foreign nationals can volunteer as long as they are not paid. A former Labour activist who volunteered for Barack Obama's 2008 campaign has dismissed Trump's complaint, calling it a political stunt.
And what about the Labour members here in Kent? Have we heard anything from them on this issue?
I have to be honest, it's very quiet on that front. No Kent Labour members have commented publicly on the matter as far as we've seen.
And what about the Tories?
Haven't seen anything from them either. Equally as quiet.
Okay, all right, okay. They've been overwhelmed by indifference. Okay, and finally, what's been happening off that car? Well, there's a cargo ship that's running aground or something off the coast of Margate. What's happening with that?
Yeah, it's anchored off the coast of Margate. It's Ruby, a Maltese-owned and flagged vessel. It's been out there 11 miles off the coast of Margate since the 25th of September, awaiting repairs. Now, there have been some concern about this on social media because she's carrying around 20,000 tonnes of ammonium nitrate on board. That's about 7 times more than the amount that caused an explosion in Beirut, Lebanon, killing more than 200 people in 2020. But this week, veteran Kent MP Sir Roger Gale says he met with the Maritime Minister Mike Kane amid concerns about the vessel. He says negotiations are ongoing to unload the cargo.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Kent County Council Conservative member Sean Holden is one of at least 24 Tories ready to step down at next May's eagerly awaited KCC election. And he joins us today. Welcome, Sean. Thanks for joining us. Firstly, you represent Cranbrook on Kent County Council, which is probably arguably one of the safer seats. Why have you decided to knock it on the head after 12 years?
Well, there's a saying that all politics ends or political careers end in failure. I didn't want that to happen, but I don't believe it would if I were to stay on. I think we would still hold this seat. But I've done my bit. And I've done 12 years on Kent County Council and 16 years I did. I stood down from it in Tunbridge Wells Borough Council. So I've done my bit, I feel. And I'm going to be 70 in January. Everyone says, wow, I don't believe that. But I am. I don't believe that, but I am. And so I was going to devote the time remaining to travelling with my beautiful wife, Corinna, and to hobbies and doing other things than politics.
I suppose the question is, do you think that Conservatives can get re-elected as the ruling administration next time? I mean, bearing in mind they've got 59 of 81 seats currently, most people don't seem to think that that's going to be the case in May. Do you think that they can do it?
It seems to me that the really bad start that the Labour government has made in the last 3 months actually opens up many more possibilities for the Conservatives in that 8 months' time or whatever it is, because people will be seeking an opportunity to make a protest. I know that we shouldn't be treating local elections as that, but I think that that will be a significant factor. I don't think that Labour will make the same kind of advances in the county council as it's made in parliamentary terms in Kent. And I'm not sure. When I first joined Kent County Council, the UKIP went from nowhere to becoming the official opposition in 2013 with 17 seats. I don't believe that Reform is going to do that. They may get some representation, but I think that the negative feeling that is running through British politics at the moment will benefit the Conservatives. I know we shouldn't be saying, oh, we like to benefit from negative things, but I think the reality is that that is what's going to happen. So I don't believe we're going to lose control next year.
But I suppose the big unknown threat is from Reform. They may not win as many seats as perhaps they think they do, and certainly you don't seem to think they're going to get that many. They may get a few, but they may determine the result of quite a few seats.
That's true. And that's something that was concerning. In fact, when I stood for Parliament in 2001 in Chatham and Aylesford, and the UKIP was a concern then that it might take enough votes away from Conservatives to let in other parties, Labour in particular. But I'm not sure that we are necessarily in that situation in the County Council. I think there are different things operating at local level, including local things, the benefit of incumbency, and as I say, the national picture, which says that maybe the government needs to be taught a lesson. It won't necessarily be taught a lesson by people switching to Reform in the way that the government was taught a lesson when it was the Conservative government and people switched to Reform. So I'm not unaware of the risk from reform, but I don't believe it will materialise as a way of seeing the Conservatives out of office in Kent County Council.
But do you think that Reform UK could have a significant effect on some results, perhaps where Labour were targeting, or it would be expected to win, or at least have a very good chance?
That might well be the case. I mean, Reform has said that its targeting is now going after the Labour Party because they're the government. And if Reform is anything, and UKIP and Nigel Farage, it's anti-government. So that may do some harm to Labour. As I say, I'm not immune to the idea that it could harm the Conservatives, but I'm fairly upbeat that we will benefit from a tide swinging in favour of the Conservative Party, or not the Labour Party, if that's probably more accurate.
There's been quite a lot made of late about the fact that some pollsters, or there's been a couple of polls where the polling's actually quite close between the Conservatives and Labour. But if you look at the pollsters, where the ones that compile poll of polls, I mean, you know, the Tories are way behind Labour even now. So I suppose it's quite difficult to really take the polls terribly seriously so soon after a general election, I guess.
Well, the polls in the general election were quite radically wrong, it seemed to me, that we were going in 20 points behind, but the eventual difference was, I think, nine points or thereabouts.
Yeah, but the actual predicted seats was nearly always spot on, though. I mean, all the big pollsters, the New Statesman pollsters, Electoral Calculus, they were, generally speaking, they were broadly correct. If you added them all together and divided by three, that you'd probably find that they came out with a near-perfect result. They said that the Labour Party was going to get more than 400 seats and you guys were going to get less than 130, and they were right in nearly every case.
Well, that's fair enough, and that's a different way of looking at the polling, and of course an important way, because we have the first past the post voting system. But let's not forget that the Labour Party's position is based on a score of about 33% of the vote, and that's usually the score that the party which comes second in a general election gets, not the winning party. So their position, although it looks fantastically strong in terms of parliamentary seats, in terms of votes on the ground, is actually very precarious.
Yeah, it's quite fragile.
And a switch, you know, even if there's a move, and there's been talk about it, that they move from that 33% to 29%, and then some polls have had them only 1% ahead of the Conservatives. But a small movement in that, as I say, precarious position could have significant effect on Labour's position in Parliament, but also, you know, as we're talking about the upcoming county council election. I mean, it's very hard to make those calculations clearly, and I know that people are experienced in doing that. And in the end, we have to say we've got to appeal to as many voters as we can and try to get them not to be interested in the opposition. That's what we'll do. And I think that will probably be enough. I do think that we will probably drop our majority on the county council. I think it's only realistic to think that. But I don't think that we'll be conceding the administration to anybody else.
Mm. Tell us a little bit about your background, because you did work as a journalist for quite a long time, and how you ended up in local politics. Briefly,
I've always been interested in politics, and I actually joined the Conservative Party when I was 16 because my father was needing people to vote him into office in some local thing. But I was a parliamentary candidate in 2001. I was a councillor in Hampshire between 2002 and 2006. And as I said, you know, I've done 16 years on the borough council here and 12 years on the county council. As a journalist, I was a political correspondent for TVAM. So I was on national television talking about politics and in the age of Mrs. Thatcher. And I was actually there for the downfall of Mrs. Thatcher in Parliament, which was quite a historic place to be.
Sure it was.
And before that, I was in local radio, and I was a political editor in local radio. So I've always had an interest in political journalism, which kind of naturally feeds into an interest in politics, or the other way around. But anyway, that was always been something in my life, and I stood for Parliament. It's the one regret I have in politics, is I didn't get elected to Parliament, but I was trying to go against the Tony Blair ocean wave.
Yeah, wrong era.
Yes, because Chatham and Aylesford did become conservative.
It did, didn't it? Yeah. For quite a long time. Yeah, I mean, if you were to stand in May, and one of the big problems that faces the Conservatives is that people might still stay at home. You might not be able to get people to come out and vote for you. What would your message be on a local level to a Conservative voter who was a bit unsure about whether to go out?
Well, I think that it's a commitment to... It depends how they change the way local government is financed with the new government. And there has been talk of whether or not they would... remove the cap on council tax increases that the Conservatives put in place many years ago. If that happens, then there is a real risk where the Conservative administration to fall, that people could see an administration coming in with their council tax very significantly increased. So one of the things I'll be saying is that we will undertake to make sure that people have still a low tax administration, that we have properly managed finances. And it's notable that in the budget debates, every time we say we're going to reduce spending on this or that, that the opposition come in and demand that we don't carry out these cuts and demand that we spend more. And so they have a sort of very irresponsible view, if you like, of council finances. And I think that's a very strong appeal to people, that they want to know things are being run properly, that their tax pounds aren't being wasted, and that they aren't going to be demanded more of them. That would be my strongest.
Just turning back to you, there's been a couple of things that you'll be remembered for as a county councillor, certainly in the time that I've been covering it. Your relentless pursuit of utility companies digging up the roads and not doing any work. There was one of yours, you set up an inspectorate to try and sort that out with increasing success from what I can gather. What sort of prompted that particular campaign to get underway?
Well, one of the things I try to do in representing people is to see what's... And it's the same with journalism, which I'm sure you find, is that it's important to know what interests people, what's important to people, what matters to people. And from personal experience, in terms of finding every time I drove more than 10 miles that I had at least 4 diversions or roads closed, and it was actually a nuisance and adding to my ability to get around, which I thought, well, I'm obviously not going to be the only one here. And I find that everyone I talk to has a story about it. Everyone is irritated by it. And the thing that particularly annoys them is when they see roadworks for days with nobody doing anything, or when they see that signs go up saying road closed on a Friday evening, when they know that there's going to be no work starting until Monday morning or Tuesday morning if it's a bank holiday weekend, which I've seen done, and signs not taken down when the work's finished. So there's still apparently a diversion. Also, diversion signs where you see one diversion sign and that's the last one you see. So all that is a mess.
Didn't you come up with a statistic that for every mile of road the KCC looks after, it's dug up at least 3 times a year, each mile?
Yes, that was the start. On average.
I
first raised a question about this in 2019, and I said, how come we now have 4,000 road closures a year when 2 years ago we only had 3,000? Last year the figure was 12,000. This year it's 16,000. We've got 5,500 miles of road in Kent, which means on a rough average, every single mile of Kent's 5,500 miles of road is being dug up 3 times a year. And of course, people will know that many more times in some cases. There's a road just near me which has been dug up 13 times in the last 12 months or so.
I know, it's funny, but it's not funny. It's absolutely infuriating.
But I have to say, I had a meeting with the new inspectors, because I'm the chairman of the Environment and Transport Committee, and I led the charge to get appointed new inspectors to go around and make sure that the people who dig the roads abide by the conditions under which they've got the permit to do it, and fine them if they don't.
But the fines are pitiful though, aren't they?
Yeah, the problem is, and so we're pressing now for better fines, that the fine levels are set by government and they are pathetic.
We're talking about less than £100 on average per breach.
Yeah, so if you say to, Southeast Water or whatever, electricity, we're sticking a fine of £70, it's only £35 if you pay it quickly. You know, what do they care? It needs to be in the thousands,
doesn't it? Yes,
and that's what we want to see. I also want to see stronger, more robust decisions that they don't have to close this road. You can put traffic lights in or traffic management and keep one side of it open. But it's a long struggle against the inertia of bureaucracy and the way we've always done things.
Yeah, well, let's hope somebody keeps it up when you're gone. Another one of the things I knew you were very keen on talking about, and something which I was aware of, but I didn't actually realise it was you that started it, well, along with an officer, is Plan B. Tell our listeners what Plan B is.
In 2013, when I was just new on the council, I read that a third to a half of all the honeybees in England and in Kent had died of starvation because of a rainy autumn, which went on and on and on, and a late spring. And I thought, oh, well, clearly we've got to do something about this. We should get people to keep more bees. I very quickly found, when I started to speak to people who actually knew what they were talking about, that, in fact, it's a question of preserving habitat or improving and extending habitat and making sure that they have enough forage, enough food to eat. And so I set up this thing called Kent's Plan B, which was to do just that. And I did it for 5 years with school competitions, and we had three summits and so on. And I did it all with the work of an officer who was taken by this idea, Alison Campbell-Smith, who did it in her spare time with me. And we did that for 5 years, and then I managed to get it adopted as the official pollinator action plan for the county council.
Brilliant.
It's gone from strength to strength. Everything the county council does now has to consider the needs of pollinators. That includes cutting road verges or their own land, you know, if you've got the right kind of flowers growing in it and in the country parks and so on.
Okay.
So it's been very successful. It's won awards, and I'm very proud of that. And I suspect that if you said in future years to my colleagues, do you remember Sean Holden? They'll say, oh yeah, Kent's Plan B.
Or Roadworks.
Yeah, possibly Roadworks. I think Plan B might.
I think you prefer to be Plan B,
wouldn't
you?
Because I haven't actually been able to stop the roadworks. But Plan B have actually done something positive. And we've had summits online.
Maybe we should have some beehives near the roadworks, and that would soon hasten their work, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Anyway, listen, just finally before we go, in just a few weeks, we'll know whether Robert Jenrick or Kemi Badenoch will be the leader of the Conservative Party. I mean, do you, in your heart of hearts, think that either of these characters stand any real chance of being a leader that can win the next general election?
I've already cast my vote, and I cast it for Kemi Badenoch. And the reason is, one of the things, I after TVAM closed, I got a job as the head of broadcasting and sort of chief spin doctor of the Conservative Party for the 1992 election. And it's very, very important, politics on television, how you look, how you sound, the feel that you convey, much more, in fact, than the particular words that you say. And I think the Conservative Party needs to look like it's new, needs to look like it's changing itself in its vibe, but at the same time, going back to the old, because my concern with the party is that it's drifted far, far away from what I think of as conservatism, which is free enterprise, free speech, people taking responsibility for themselves, strong defence, sound finances. And I don't think we've done any of those things. I'm very critical of the Conservative government in the last few years. And I think Kemi Badenoch will make the party look different and feel different and be more appealing to people. And I've watched her for a number of years anyway, because I like the way she talks. She tells it like it is, and she's not looking at taking on any sort of nonsense. And she's real got a downer on woke. And I want to see that put forward, because I think we're under a huge threat of free speech in this country because of wokeness. And I hope that Kemi Badenoch will do something different. Robert Jenrick, I think, a jolly good, fine Conservative politician. But from the point of view of looks, he just looks like some Tory bloke. He just looks like more of the same. And Kemi Badenoch will make the party look very different. So that's my hope. I think she'll be a strong leader. And more important, she'll make people take notice of the Conservative Party in a way that I don't think that Robert Jenrick will be quite able to do.
Do you think that to have a right-winger in charge of the party is important when you've got reform breathing down your neck?
I was concerned about what people mean by right wing, because I always used to think of right wing as you know, very right, you know, like almost fascist. And I don't believe that she is or I am. I'm centre-right, but all those things I said. And I reject socialism. I reject strong government interfering in citizens' lives and the government knowing best and all that. I reject all that. But I don't think that's right wing. But yes, I think going back to those values, which reform has espoused, and you know what, I will be quite frank, everything that I've seen about reform, I don't really disagree with anything that they're saying.
Which is probably a little bit worrying from a card-carrying Conservative member, that you do see a lot of the things in their policies that perhaps have deserted the Conservative Party.
Have deserted the Conservative Party and gone to reform because they're saying the things that the Conservative Party should be saying. And I think Kemi Badenoch will be saying.
Sean, listen, thank you very much indeed for your time. It's been a pleasure to speak to you as always, and hope to keep in touch.
Okay, well, thank you.
The government has appealed to this great nation of ours to offer opinions on the future of the NHS. Surely nothing could go wrong with that. Rob, I understand you've been keeping an eye on what people have been saying. What kind of suggestions have been made?
Yeah, so this is a consultation on new ideas that could help the NHS. And what is quite unusual is that all of the responses are public. So you can see everything that anybody has written. And as soon as people realised this, all of a sudden some rather ridiculous suggestions came in. But at the beginning, there were quite a few sincere ones, ranging from quite sensible things, such as digitising records and keeping them centrally. So no matter what hospital or GP you go to, your doctor will always know all of the conditions you've had in the past. Very sensible idea. However, other less sensible ones were tip stations at GP practices, where basically you could donate £5 to £10 if you felt like it every time you went, and it would go to that GP practice. Others were no healthcare at all for anybody who smokes or for obese people. A lot of results were for cutting all diversity spending and diversity roles and that sort of thing. And particularly one thing that we often hear as a criticism of the NHS, that it's too top heavy to get rid of a lot of managers. Others that we commonly hear, fines for missed appointments. There was one specific one which must have been a bugbear of a particular person, which was turn the temperature of wards down by 1 degree. And the comment on that was, I recently spent some time in a hospital ward and it was just too hot, so could we turn it down a little bit and you'd probably save some money, which is probably you would.
Obviously, if you do that, then obviously you save on the bills, yeah?
Yes. Okay. Another suggestion, which I thought was quite sweet, was NHS TV, which would just have programming about how nice things that are happening in the NHS at the moment.
Which you're going to inflict this on people in the ward.
Yes, I think that is it.
All day long. That'll soon get them better, won't it?
And finally, one which is hard to tell, it was just on the cusp of when people started to realise that these response to the public, and was to have Tony Blair be the head of the NHS, to run it with Alan Milburn as his deputy.
Is that some sort of a punishment of the poor man? Hasn't he done enough to the country?
Yeah.
Okay. The other thing we were going to talk a little bit, it kind of runs alongside this, is the assisted dying vote. Dan, you know, where do you think this is all going to go?
Whether it will pass in Parliament or not, I don't know, and the vote actually comes. Something that I don't think has been looked at that might play out in a weird way is that politicians are disproportionately religious compared to the average member of the population. I think it's something like 60% of MPs identify as strongly religious or go to church regularly or something like that.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's higher than the average population. Whether you believe what politicians say about their own beliefs and spiritual practices is a different question.
Yeah.
But if that's to be believed, I would imagine some of them are a bit more, not conservative, but sceptical on this issue.
A few of them have gone to prison as well, haven't they?
Yeah. But basically, it'll be a free vote, you know, so the party won't whip MPs to vote a particular way, which is kind of traditional with large, quite controversial changes to sort of social policy. So when Harold Wilson's government in the 1960s abolished the death penalty and legalised homosexuality, those were free votes and private members' bills. Mm. And the similar thing will happen here. But obviously, as it stands at the moment, the scope of the legislation is for people who are terminally ill and who have, you know, X period of time to live. But I think what campaigners are raising and is worth talking about is that everywhere that already has assisted dying legislation, with very few exceptions, the trajectory is always towards liberalisation. There's a lot of many people describe as horror stories coming out of Canada and that sort of thing.
Yeah, the slippery slope down towards
you know, people euthanizing people that they feel don't have a quality of life, but that's not...
Or people who are mentally ill, for example. There was even about 10 years ago in, I think it's Belgium or the Netherlands, it was perfectly legitimate to apply for assisted suicide on the grounds of intractable mental illness. And there's a documentary, I think made by The Economist, about a 23-year-old Belgian woman applying to end her own life with the support of doctors because she had mental health problems. And also, I wonder if people raise this in Parliament, is that in a country where the NHS has been raised to almost the standard of a civic cult, and it's essentially a national religion where we're expected to make quite tremendous sacrifices for the healthcare system, which is in fact meant to protect us, I'd be concerned that the NHS and its well-being could be weaponized in quite a sinister way when it comes to euthanasia, even without the direct intention of politicians in that direction.
Okay, folks, that's your lot this week. Thanks to Gabriel, Rob, Dan, and our special guest, Sean Holden. Don't forget to keep an eye on kentonline.com/politics for the latest news from around the county. You can also sign up to our newly launched politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters/. And finally, don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. I'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.